C1A. Number 17A.
So, in truth of mind, we first see that in atoning with God, we can't help but to see that God is really the source and the author of man and the universe. If we perceive that, well, then we have only reached the point of mind. And so, in the measure as, like the Virgin Mary, we nurture that in our spiritual sense, and let that illuminate some nearer and bigger in our spiritual sense. In that measure we really conceive of this idea and it develops. So that atoning with God then, after having perceived that God is the only author, source, creator of man and the universe, that begins to develop something in us and brings forth which is of the nature of a more spiritual idea. More spiritual idea. What is born to us is something relative. It is not yet always the absolute and complete sense of it, just as with the Virgin Mary. It was a more spiritual idea. She is but too partly of Mary's earthly condition, though she was fully endowed with the divine spirit, and so could give a more spiritual idea of man. Well, that's what happens in us all the time. Whatever is born in us is always a gradual development of something which is absolute and which is in its fullness at hand, but not yet fully revealed and demonstrated. Then she goes on to the third, truth as soul, and in that paragraph, now where we come to soul, where the identity is shown, there she couples now Jesus and the Christ. Up to this point in truth's mind and truth's spirit, she didn't couple the term Jesus, who partook mainly of Mary's earthly condition, with the Christ, the divine spirit with which he was fully endowed. Here now in soul, she couples it and she speaks about the Christ Jesus as the individual ideal now of truth. We come now to soul, in which we see that Jesus as a fleshly person, fully endowed with spiritual, could give an individual expression of that truth. I like that always. I always like when it is shown that we still can be material and bodily and have a mortal sense, and yet that cannot prevent us from going forward. That shows that though he partook partly of the flesh, that couldn't stop him to go forward. That was his demonstration. That matter, the world, error, persecution, all that thing couldn't do a thing to the spiritual development of men. And I like that. I think I like it because one always has still a lot of flesh burden and persecution and drawbacks and defeat on one shoulder. And the Comforter comes in here and says, well, that can't do anything. It's the Mosaic law that says, an eye for an eye, and what is it says, and whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. It's the Mosaic law that says, that seems to say, that you have to work out your salvation with blood and tears and so on. But as Paul says in Romans, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And if by grace, then it is no more of work. Otherwise, grace is no more grace. Jesus came as the individual ideal of truth. He just showed that if when sticking to the true idea of man, one just sticks to it, whatever comes. And that, therefore, he couldn't be anything else but the representative of soul. The new executor of God, is he called here. He couldn't, at that point, when something is given birth in us, well, then that something spiritual, we love it so much, and we value it so much that we stick to it, no matter what comes against it, no matter what the opposition is. And so we begin to represent the true man. We begin to represent soul, which always it is and never deviates from what it is. It has identity and integrity, and therefore he could be the new executor of God by having that control of soul over sense. Jesus remained, so to say, in the nature of God. That was his the third step, really. That having the spirit of it, he says, all right, and I remain in it. No matter if I'm opposed, no matter if I'm cursed, no matter if they try to hinder me or persecute me or kill me or whatever it is, I always remain the same. I always remain as a representative of what has been born divinely in me. He never tried to represent the flesh, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. He began to be the new executor of God and said, no matter what you say and what you do with me, my job is to represent God. And God is unchangeable and therefore never changes in its attitude towards the world. She says here something very interesting. She says, we cannot choose for ourselves, but must work out our salvation in the way Jesus taught, meekness and might and thought. That, you see, we cannot choose for ourselves. We can only work it out the way Jesus worked it out. Perhaps you get a little bit tired of me by repeating that since last autumn, that there is only one way, that there are not thousand ways to Rome. There is only one way, a principled way. Whatever that principle, from whatever standpoint that principle is looked at, that principle has many standpoints to look at, but it's always principled. And so it is always a principled way. The standpoints may vary. We may look at something from an objective point of view, from a subjective point of view, from the seven or from the four. We may look at it from many ways. From the days of creation, we may look at them from the synonymous terms. But it's always a principle. And so here in the textbook, showing that principle of prayer, principle of atonement, principle of marriage, and so on, shows there is only a principled way. And Jesus showed it. And that's the way Matthew shows it too, as the way. Mark and Luke and John don't show the way. They show something else. Mark shows the influx of the Christ. Luke shows the union of manhood, the relationship of manhood, and John shows the implication of science. But Mark shows the way, and therefore Mark is Matthew shows the way, and therefore Matthew is written in exactly the same way as this section of truth. You will, if you have time, think that over. You will find that there is an enormous exact correlative between these six subjects depicting Jesus' spiritual way from conception to ascension and universality of the Christ scientist with what the Gospel of Matthew shows. And besides that, we will find an enormous clear correlation between this six subject and the sixth day of creation with its subtone. If you have time in your holidays, perhaps you don't have. I think I wouldn't have. I would have a jolly good holiday. But it's precise that you have that and you want to refresh really the impact, true spiritual impact of the sixth day. Just take that summary of John Dolley at the end of the first volume of the Bible Talk and compare what he epitomizes there as truth of mind, truth of spirit and so on with what she says here about it. And it's amazing the correlation you will find. Why? It isn't because there is a correlation. It is because science is always saying. And so it had to come, if looked from the point of view of the way of life, or from the looked at it from the point of view of the word of life, it had to come to Matthew in the same spiritual order as it had to come to the writers of the days of creation and as it had to come to Mary Baker Eddy when she writes about it. So the wonder is not that they correlate. The wonder of it is that there is one principle about it, and it's the principle which can be symbolized in many ways. So here we begin to see, you see, that if we give birth to our true manhood in truth of spirit, and that in that point and that measure as we begin to conceive of what really the true man in us consists of, then something in us says, and I seek this. I don't let go anymore of that nature, of that divine nature. No matter what the opposition may be, no matter what the difficulties may be, I stick to that nature, and I don't waver anymore. And so I remain in that integrity of the divine nature. Then he goes on to principle, truth of principle, and shows that atoning with God, we take up a divine relationship. That because that which has been born in us is impersonal, completely impersonal, and is therefore of the nature of ideas, we begin to see that we are only related to ideas and no more to people. That's the point where he says, Jesus acknowledged no ties of the flesh, where he said, call no man your father which is on earth, for one is your father. Again he asked, who is my brother and who are my brethren, implying that they who do the will of the Father, that they are his relatives. It is that point which is, I think, in the life of each one, right, where we just have to mean business about it, where we just have to see that if we are not willing to leave father, mother, sisters and brother and relatives, and I don't know, for Christ's sake, that we are not doing our job. In the various Gospels, we hear so often Jesus saying something like this, he that loveth father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. Or everyone that has forsaken houses or brethren or sisters or father or mother for my sake shall receive an hundredfold and shall inherit eternal life. Now this doesn't mean that whenever we don't like it, we just leave father and mother. Just that whenever we are a bit upset about them, that we just say, well, go to heaven. he's very explicit in saying, who loves them more than me, and for my sake. See, it's a comparison with the Christ. It isn't a comparison with other people that we should leave father and mother and so on and so on and so on and so on because of other people or because of other this or other that. It's always a comparison with the Christ. He has only two classifications here, and that's the one classification is adherence to the divine principle, to the Christ principle. And the false classification is adherence to people. And the atonement canon says, go and atone yourself with the Christ principle and with what the Christ principle has in store for you. And then subordinate to that all human relationship. Mrs. Eddy was very definite about these passages when, for instance, you read her Divinity Course. Time and time again she points out that is a proof of how much we are really willing to lay down the mortal, the false sense of relationship, the false personal sense, and begin to see that we are near to them who do the will of God. And we know that. We know that we feel much freer and happier and so on with those who are impersonal about science and who work in the line of science. They are next to our heart and become more and more next to our heart. And all of us, to a certain extent, some more, some less, have to prove that even if we have to bite in that bitter apple, as we say in German, to subordinate family relationship to our high calling of doing that what principle asks us to do. And we have to give that when it comes. Then he goes on to truth as life and shows that atoning with God, we partake really of being, of the truth of being, of the true bread and wine. Here, it's a rather long passage here, goes over pages. It has all to do with Jesus' sense of Eucharist, of the sense that the Son of Man has to go, that the time comes when human sense of life and the mortal sense of life has to be subordinated to a spiritual sense of life. And that is the Eucharist. It says of that Eucharist that it is the cup shows forth his bitter experience, the cup which he prayed might pass from him, though he bowed in holy submission to the divine decree. He says it was a mournful occasion, a sad supper taken at the close of day, twilight of a glorious career, with shadows fast falling around, and this supper closed forever, forever. Jesus' ritualism or concession to Matthew, it is that point where in Matthew so often hear him say, the Son of Man has to go. He has to go for what? For the Son of God, for the Christ. It's that point where perhaps we say, let the cup be passed before me, where we shrink back of drinking the cup. Because it is seen here we give birth to man as purely spiritual, as living in the purely spiritual, where we give up the belief of man living in matter, and that seems always to be a cup of bitterness. And yet, we know from our experience, a little we have demonstrated in that way, as it has always blessed us, that in the manner as we were willing to lay down our mortal selfhood, our prestige, our ambition, in the measure as we were willing to put ourselves out of the way, to put Mary out of the way, as Mrs. Eddy called it, that we always gain more. We know that law, and that's the comforter. That the comforter says, you know that law, and that law promises you that if we accept truth as life, that it pushes us on to truth as truth. That if we accept truth as life, namely to give up the Son of Man, that the Son of Man must go, that then the Christ can come, and that only then the Christ can come. And she shows what that means in the next atone of truth as truth. She shows that in the measure as we atone with God, we really are then clothed with the mind of Christ. He calls it the holy struggle. And it's a very impressive tone going over a few paragraphs in which she shows what is the holy struggle. The holy struggle is really this of being willing to accept that tone of laying down the mortal in truth as life. The human element struggles with the divine. It begins usually with a struggle, where the human element struggles with the divine and says, let the human be divinified. Can you say that? Let the human become divine. That's the struggle. And the Christ says, no, the divine is divine, and the divine remains divine. The human cannot be made divine. The human is human. And so Jesus said, all right, thy will be done, not mine. He was willing to lay down the human sense of it for the divine. Let not the flesh but the spirit be represented in me. He yielded to that struggle. It is the question of what he says, to give all for Christ or truth. To leave all for the Christ Prince. It's a high demand, a high calling. And so she asks there in the side notes incisive questions. Yes, there are six incisive questions, and they all turn around the same point. Namely, they are all turning around the point, are you willing to accept life as truth, drinking the cup? Are you willing to take the Eucharist, that mournful occasion where we close forever any concession to matter, where we are willing to lay down our human ambition, human sense, prestige, and all that? And she says, if we do, if we yield to this struggle, if we give up that struggle and accept the divine, then God is with you. Then we come to the Emmanuel, God with us, a friend with us. He again at the tone of, sub-tone of truth. You always get that sense, now I have it. The first five tones are always clearing up things and clearing up things. The word of life always clears up things. And then when it is cleared up, when all the material objections and the human objections against the truth is given up, then truth comes in its full brightness and its full glory and its vastness and says, all right, here I am. I am here. God with us. You see, it's again in Italy, just as he uses to write at one moment in Italy, in the subtones of truth. And what is this Christ, you see, that really comes in? And next time, I guess I will have more time than today. Next time, if I have time. I like to show the correlation of this subject with the sixth day of creation. And perhaps you will have the love and the hunger and the desire to go against those enormous, vital, and deep, verbatim reports of Mr. Dole about the sixth day of creation and see what he says here. There he too epitomizes the sixth as the Christ, the truth of truth, as the Christ. What is it? You see, it's no more the individual ideal of truth. It's the whole Christ. The whole Christ. And here the whole Christ is shown as that which says, if individually we lay down the Son of Man in truth as life, then we make it collective and universal. Then the Christ is a fact, is a God with us, no more a God with me. No more a God with me. It's a God with us. It's God with the universe. And so it is here where she says, well, that revolutionizes the world. Doesn't revolutionize me, does much more. It revolutionizes the world. A truth is then no more individual. The moment I lay down my folk individuality and give up me as a mortal, material, human individuality and begin to see that truth is truly indivisible, individual, indivisible from truth, then truth is all. Then truth is collective and universal. And so what has been born then in me, that true manhood, that true knowledge, that true insight, that true touch of what man consists of, is no more me, it's man, a compound idea. So Mr. Dole, here, I just don't know how he saw those things. I just don't know. I think he didn't know himself. I think he didn't know himself. It just revealed himself to him. It just poured on him. It just impressed on him. He just had to be a scribe and a revelator under order, just as Mr. Dole had to write a textbook. He epitomized truth as the Christ, which comes to us as the compound idea man. Those are the two terms. Christ compound idea man. Here you have it. It's giving all for Christ. And giving all for Christ, we have that fellowship with Christ. And what does it do? How does it translate itself to itself? It doesn't translate itself to us as the Son of Man that has come. It translates itself as the compound idea man. As man universally seen, and therefore he says, that's why this insight revolutionized the whole world. That's why Jesus revolutionized the whole world. He gave to the whole world a new trend. He gave to the new world a new ideal which lasted all over those centuries. It wasn't individual. If the Christ would only be individual, and if he would only have worked out something individual, it would have been his nice job to do, and we would say, well, he did it. But he did more than that. He did it for himself. He changed the world. He impressed the world with a completely new concept. And all the billions of people living since then have all been impressed and by that impress of the Christ. And it began to revolutionize the world. And he says, and that will bring in the millennium. You see, it's again universe. So it has that fellowship with Christ, which she has a sign of fellowship with Christ, has not only an individual effect, that is smallest part of it. It is man. The whole concept of man becomes a life in the universe. And so we see the job we do. Perhaps we don't see it always, because we always see what does it do for me. And even then, when we see what does it do for me, we even judge it humanly and materially. It's all so wrong. It's all so wrong because we don't trust in the science. In any other science, you just trust in the law which is given. And you know, that's the law, no matter what other people may think about it, no matter what it looks like on the blackboard and so on, and you make it the law. And the law says to us all, to every one of us, it says, give birth to your true manhood. No, that's not quite right. Give birth to true manhood.